Hello, and welcome to episode 244 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I'm joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
I've been thinking lately about the difference between ethics and morality, two words we often use interchangeably. A recent situation in sports media brought this topic into focus. Reporter Diana Rossini faced professional consequences, which included losing her job, after questions were raised about a relationship with Mike Vrabel, one that, according to reports, overlapped with her role covering the National Football League. Vrabel, an NFL head coach, did not face comparable consequences. This struck many as confusing. If two people were involved, why did only one face repercussions? Part of the answer may be that expectations tied to their roles are quite different. Journalists are expected to maintain independence and avoid conflicts of interest. Coaches are not. Their job is to simply win games, not remain neutral. That distinction between professional rules and personal behavior shows up in a lot of places. In general, I tend to admire people who question whether rules actually make sense. At the same time, I'm not anti-institutionalist, and I agree that rules help organizations function and can create consistency. But when those rules feel disconnected from real life or designed to limit liability more than reflect good judgment, it's not surprising that people start to lose trust. So, Rick, let's start here. When we talk about ethics and morality, what's the difference and why does it matter?
It matters because the words we use sometimes create a great deal of confusion. And in this case, the words ethics and morality create confusion because most of the time we use them interchangeably. We see that something is unethical and immoral, for example.
Mm-hmm.
What we mean to do in cases like where we use both words interchangeably, we mean to really emphasize that it's really wrong. But we don't really try to distinguish between the two. But there are certain cases where they have quite different usages, and that is when it comes to professional associations, professional standards, professional conducts. So we have things like business ethics, healthcare ethics.
Journalism ethics.
Engineering ethics. And we don't talk about engineering morality, for example, or business morality. When it comes to what's professional standards, and it tends to be fairly explicit standards, like there are codes of conduct for many professions. And we always call these ethical codes, not moral codes. And so when we distinguish between the two, what we mean to suggest is that ethics refers to the more the public professional. Morality refers to what tends to be more personal and private. However, there is overlap. So that's what makes it confusing.
And of course, we should say that this podcast has been, for all 244 episodes, called The Ethical Life.
And yet we talk about morality, the personal, more private, and mm-hmm. we talk about the public. Right?
Exactly. Yeah. And is that sort of a good way for a lot of people to think about this, is sort of internal judgment versus external rules?
Yeah. What complicates it, though, is that the external rules tend to come from our internal judgment. That is, like, when we develop really firmly established social norms regarding something, even if it's regarding private or personal behavior, and then think that that behavior ought to extend, say, into our businesses and into our professions, and then we make it explicit rules for those, then it goes to the subject matter of ethics. And so that's how they tend to have an overlap. In the same way, oftentimes we have ethics expectations that become laws because we think that it expresses a standard that we ought to enforce, right, and provide punishments if people don't act by them. For example, like we have laws concerning cruelty to animals. That used to be something that was looked down upon, but not illegal. And so it was regarded as something, well, you're not a good person if you, like, kick your dog. But now if you see somebody beating their dog, you can report them and they can be... The police can be involved. And so morals, ethics, and even laws have a sort of continuum to them.
And there's certainly things, and I'll just pick on a profession I know very little about, but electricians are important. And I'm sure they have, there's a pretty rigorous process about becoming an electrician. There's an apprentice program oftentimes, and you get some certification. And I would imagine, too, that in that profession, if you're consistently and knowingly doing the wrong thing, you may not be an electrician very long. That doesn't mean you're going to call the cops on that person unless they're, negligently trying to burn a house down, but they could just be doing sloppy work. And that's, I think, in a way, why we have a lot of these organizations. And I guess to take that a step further, I can only speak for this country. I assume this is in other developed countries around the world as well. But I think we sort of underappreciate the importance of these professional organizations that have been around for, decades, if not centuries, in some cases, maybe, around important things like the law and medicine and, electricians that sort of govern practices around these professions that are pretty important to our lives.
Many of the professional associations have been around a very long time. It was only in the 1980s and 1990s that most of them started to develop explicit ethical codes and calling them ethical codes. They might have had codes of conduct or codes of professional conduct and so forth. But at a certain point, most of them developed codes of ethics that were designed mostly to protect both the integrity and the reputation of the profession. And almost all professions have some kind of code regarding honesty, for example, not lying to your clients, to the people you're representing, to your customers, that sort of thing. Some of the professions, take, for example, engineering, the different kinds of engineering, because there's civil engineering, there's electrical engineering and so forth, one of the professional codes for engineers is that they not practice outside of their area of expertise. So if you're a civil engineer, you can't take a client who wants you to do electrical engineering or vice versa. That's something that's kind of unique to that profession. You don't have that sort of thing for journalists, for example.
No, you can cover the city hall and go to cover a high school sporting event the next night, and nobody's going to, people might think it's interesting you're doing that, but no, you're not going to get in trouble for it.
So then you could ask, well, why would engineering have that? Well, because people would, say that they're an engineer, give advice, and people don't realize this guy's an electrical engineer. He hasn't studied civil engineering at all, and here he's giving me advice on how to build this building, and people are going to be up on the second floor, and they might not be safe. And so most of these codes develop, they get refined when bad things happen. And they say, okay, we can't allow this bad thing to happen anymore. Let's create a rule prohibiting it.
And it's interesting, and wasn't aware that you said that this became much more structured in the 80s and 90s as these professions sort of got more organized and put together these rules. And I mean, I think that all makes sense, right? And a lot of it, as you said, that you not only want to keep these, whatever you're doing, being done properly and in many cases safely, but you also want to protect the honorableness of the profession, right? But also at the same time, it seems like those are in most cases things you can quantify, that you can write down these rules and say, if you're going to, be a structural engineer, here's the things you have to do and follow. And a lot of it, I'm sure, is physics. And that doesn't change very much.
You're right in that a lot of it seems pretty cut and dried lots of times. So there's very explicit rules. And it's interesting, if you look through the professional codes, in many cases, they are very detailed. Lawyers, for example,
yes,
have a very detailed set of instructions for appropriate conduct that can get you disbarred or get you into...
And there are some even legal issues. You can get into legal trouble there, I think, more so than other professions, probably.
Yeah, but you know, there's all, a lot of it is just like protecting the integrity of that
exactly profession. Of the process.
Yeah. So, for example, in Wisconsin, there are several regions that are established by the Wisconsin Supreme Court that issue judicial review. So when a complaint comes in, it is sent to that review committee, who then decides and whether there's been a violation of the code and what sort of sanctions are called for. But here's why, no matter how precise those codes are, you still need judgment to just ask the question sometimes, yeah, but the person might have violated the code in a strict sense, but did they do something that's wrong? And this is where that use of the term ethical can come to have two meanings. It might be a violation of the ethics code, and yet in another sense, not really wrong in our kind of ordinary judgment. So I'll give you an example. I know a person who was doing some home renovations, and he wanted to take a supporting wall out of his house. And he wasn't hiring this was out in the country. He wasn't hiring a contractor to do it. He was doing the work himself. And he was going to put a steel beam in to support the roof on the second floor.
So he thought he had some idea what to do.
He asked a buddy of his who happened to be an electrical engineer.
Mm.
And he says, and the buddy looked at it and did some quick calculations, said, what you're doing is probably not sufficient. And he told him, you probably need this, but you should ask somebody who knows more about it. Well, he didn't ask anybody who knows more about it. He went in. So is the electrical engineer telling him he needs more support in there? Is he operating outside of his area of expertise? Strictly speaking, yes.
But he's also probably erring on the side of caution, right?
But he's also erring on the side of caution. And he's talking to somebody that he knows isn't going to get advice from a civil engineer.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And so that case, he's probably doing the right thing, but it's strictly against the code. Mm-hmm. So, and this happens all the time. And you can never imagine all the ways, every action that you might anticipate can't be written down in a rule book. That's the problem.
One thing, and like I mentioned in the intro, is, you know, a lot of what we're talking about here are rules that are put in place. And sometimes I think they make sense, and there are sometimes they don't. And I do respect people who are smart about asking questions about, like, is this really important? Does this make sense? And I can think of numerous times in my life where I'll look at something and say, well, this doesn't make sense to me. And then somebody who's a lot smarter in this area will say, well, you probably haven't thought about it this way, but it does make sense. And they explain it out. And I'm like, oh, well, gosh, that I looked at it in a whole different way. And that can happen. And I think that can be something we can all learn from. I'm going to share a story here that's probably a little personal, but I mean, it happens to everybody. Next week, I have a colonoscopy, which we all know is a routine thing. Everybody of a certain age should have this, and I'm doing that, and it'll be fine, I'm sure. When I'm making the appointment with the hospital to have the procedure done, we settle on a time, and I think it's like 6 or 8 weeks out because of scheduling. And then they inform me that their policy is that within a month of the colonoscopy, I have to have what they term a heart and lung check to make sure my heart and lung are sufficiently strong and stable enough for this procedure. And I mean,
I had never heard of that.
I've never heard of it either. And this is my second colonoscopy, and I don't remember having this done before. But she's like, no, this is just this is what we have. This is what we do. This is what we require. And so I had two thoughts. One, I think I'm a pretty healthy person. It just seems silly. Like, it sort of seems silly. But what really also bothered me was that we all know that colonoscopies are like important and good, right? Mm-hmm. And I worried that, you know, and so, I mean, I went and got the heart and lung check, and of course that was fine, and I made the appointment. But there also are times where if you put a barrier or two in front of someone who should be doing this, and they might say, oh, I don't have time for, I have time for one appointment, but I don't have time for two appointments. And they're just going to say, to heck with it all, I didn't really want to do this anyway, and just kind of give them an excuse to get out of it. Well, I think that's bad. And so then, but fine. So I do this. I do what they tell me to do. My heart and lungs apparently are fine, or at least sufficient enough to have this procedure done. And so then a week before the appointment, they have a follow-up call just to kind of go through all the prep work and making sure you all understand what's going on. And then I said, oh, by the way, I just wanted to make sure that you saw I had my heart and lung appointment and everything is fine. You received that, right? And she looks over and she's like, I guess so. We don't really enforce that very much. And I'm just like, what? And I mean, I do plan to bring this up more in person. But like the person I spoke to was like, this is like not optional. And not only is not optional, it has to be within 30 days of your appointment, and it has to, you have to pass. And until we get that, you can't, you're not going to, you know, it's just part of the process. And then the second person I talked, and again, it seems foolish, but whatever, I do it. And then the second person's like, it's fine.
This is one of the long-standing frustrations with rules in organizations.
It's exactly what I'm getting at. Yes.
Yes, because there are the rules, and then there are the rules that are actually enforced.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know until you're inside the organization which are which, right?
Oh, and in this case, it seems that for one person, this is real important, but this is a large enough healthcare institution that for the other person, it's like, I don't really care.
It's not the biggest concern I have. Regarding colonoscopy, my biggest concern is, you know, after 25 years of teaching ethics courses at a university with a lot of nursing students, I've had hundreds of nursing students who are practicing in our healthcare institutions around here. And that's not that time where you want to meet a former student.
Especially one who you maybe gave a less than good grade to.
Yeah, well, no, because that did happen one time. I wake up, you know, come out and, oh, Dr. Kite, do you remember me? yeah, but I wish I was seeing you in a different occasion.
But do you agree, though, with my general premise, and I'm probably more, I think I am more this way than you, that it's, that I've never, I can think back to when I was a young kid, that I just never liked somebody telling me that this is the way we do it, or this is the rule, and here is, and unless it's like ridiculously obvious, like, you know, we all drive on the right side of the road. Well, I mean, with that, if we did agree to that, we'd be in trouble.
Yeah, but so rules like this, codes of conduct and rules for behavior, like set a common standard. That's really important. You can't have institutions function without some kind of shared standard, so you know what the boundaries are. The problem, they become abusive when they encroach too much on freedom of action and creativity and even engagement in the workplace. And that can happen when people try to overregulate behavior. So there's always this balance. How do we keep people safe and kind of within bounds of appropriateness, but also allow some kind of freedom of initiative and creativity and some measure of autonomy for people, which we all greatly desire. And here is, I think, where we can go back to Rossini and Vrabel. So Rossini resigns probably under pressure.
When she was working for the – and I didn't realize that. She was like the – not an reporter for the NFL. She was like the top reporter covering the NFL for The Athletic.
For The Athletic, yeah. Which is a publication of the New York Times.
Correct. Yeah.
And so it's a very high profile. She was a senior NFL reporter. She used to be on ESPN Sports Center, I believe.
Okay.
So she's worked up to the pinnacle of sports reporting.
Mm-hmm.
Mike Vrabel is head coach of the New England Patriots, so he also worked his way up to the pinnacle of NFL jobs. He does not lose his job. He's, you know, like, there's some scrutiny. There's a lot of bad publicity. I'm sure there was talks with ownership and so forth. But last weekend when the NFL draft was taking place, probably to keep from being a distraction, he stepped away and said he was going to undergo counseling.
Yeah, I saw that. I mean, like, whatever.
As of yesterday, we're recording this on a Tuesday. I think yesterday he announced that he had returned to the team now.
So the counseling was successful, apparently.
Yeah, it took 3 days or whatever. And there's,
and like, everybody rolls their eyes at this, right? I mean, like, this whole, I'm going to step away for a, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, nobody, like, thinks this is, like, serious.
It gets him out of public scrutiny.
Yeah.
But, like, all these questions, is there a double standard here? And like, no, there's no double standard.
No.
There's one standard for journalists.
Yeah.
And, being truthful and being objective are really important for journalists.
Yeah.
Because,
yeah,
if you make up sources on a story, you get fired.
Yep.
Like, that isn't a hand slap, right? if you are shown to have favorites, say you're taking payments to give favorable coverage to one team over another, like, that's fireable. You know, there's no questions asked.
Whether it's sports journalism, political journalism, anything, yes.
Yeah. Coaches aren't expected to be truthful.
In fact, they're hired for one thing:
to win. Yeah. And in fact, if they use deception to help them win, like, what you disguise coverages, you do all these things, right?
As long as you play within the rules the game has set forth.
The rules have nothing to do with having an extramarital affair.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. So there's no double standard. Now, we can both say, well, they both did something wrong. Yeah, they
morally.
Morally, yeah. When it comes to, like, societal standards for personal conduct, they both did something wrong, and the majority of people would agree.
But if she was just sold jewelry at the downtown mall, well, like, that would be, it would be much less of a story. But, she wouldn't lose her job over that, probably, nor should she.
No, no. Now, if she were the CEO of a company and it caused public embarrassment to the company, she might.
Yeah, sure. Maybe, right? So. Maybe, like, so. Like, thinking back to the Coldplay concert couple of last year.
Yeah, and that's where this becomes, there becomes some gray areas. Well, there's sometimes where people lose their job even when there's not professional standards, but there's still, I think, in those jobs, there's professional expectations of conduct. And one is, like, if you're the head of a company and you're the visible representative of it, you're not going to cause public embarrassment to the company. And so that's I would say, would still fall under the category of ethical conduct. So there's no double standard, but it's interesting. People continue to say, yeah, well, why did she lose her job and he didn't when they both did something wrong? And, well,
they have different jobs.
They have different jobs. It just comes down to that.
We've talked numerous times on this show about how there's been public is much less trustworthy of our institutions, and, you know, whether it's religious, governmental, or even the media. And how do you feel that these things we've discussed today play into losing of that trust? Do you think it's because these institutions have done a poor job of setting these ethical standards, or do you think the ethical standards they've set have been the wrong ones? Or do you think this plays into that at all?
You know, I think when it comes to public trust in institutions, it's really complex. Trust in itself, it's notoriously difficult to study. And, you know, I've looked at decades worth of studies on trust, and it's just a bear because there's so many factors that go into it. There's interpersonal trust, like, why do we trust one another? Why do you instantly trust one person and instantly distrust another? Like, that's like, we've formed these really quick judgments and so forth. And then institutional trust, that's another thing altogether. I think it comes down to like overall declining social trust. Like as a culture, we aren't as willing to extend trust as generations before us were to anybody.
I think that's absolutely true.
The other thing, and it may have contributed to this, we're getting much better at marketing. And we talk about marketing and managing public relations, that sort of thing. There's so much messaging going on that it causes us not to trust any of it. We're always being manipulated in terms of the appearance of all of these organizations. And so then we just naturally kind of become cynical, like, well, no matter what they say, they're just trying to make themselves look good. We're never getting the authentic organization from their messaging. And we tend to feel that way about our government. We have spokespersons for administrations and so forth, and we tend not to really believe anything they say. We want to see, we want to see for ourselves what happens.
But I think that's true. But also, though, you say that people are less likely to trust others than they used to. I think that's my take on that is because people think they need other people less than they used to. And I think some of that's true, right? I mean, if you were, I think living 100 years ago in an agrarian life, that you probably did rely on your neighbors more than you need to rely on your neighbors if you just live in some, you know, generic subdivision somewhere in this country. And I think the perception and often the reality is that, well, I don't trust those people because I probably don't need to. And also, I'm sure you've said this on this show, if you don't know these people, well, it's easy not to trust them.
Yeah. And I think that's the bigger factor, not because we think we don't need them, but just we don't know that we don't have a track record with them. And it's actually because we need other people less. We don't have as much interaction. And so then we don't have as much of a track record to build up trust.
So as this conversation has gone along, I wanted to touch on one more point. And I'm not even sure if it fits, but I'm going to try to like wedge this topic in and we'll see if it fits into this conversation. A lot of what we've said is sort of outside of the law. And this is something that is codified in law, but because of why it exists, it makes me slightly less trustworthy of our government and of a particular part of our local businesses. I'm sure you know, and I have no idea how common or uncommon this is across the country, but in Wisconsin, you cannot buy a car on Sunday from a dealership, nor can a dealer be open on Sunday. Mm-hmm. And again, maybe that's in most states. I don't really know. Do you know?
I know it's several states, but okay. I don't know if it's most.
Yeah. And again, we're all familiar with like blue laws from like 100 years ago where like there were restrictions on alcohol and other sort of like bad products or products that some people viewed as like negative. I never quite thought of cars that way. And I once had a conversation with someone, and this isn't just a preference. This is a state law that is, in effect, in the state of Wisconsin. And I asked someone about that, and the response was, this is a law that the car dealers actually like because they're not convinced that being open and staffing 7 days a week would sell more vehicles and increase their profit than being open 6 days a week and, in fact, may even eat into their profits a little bit. And so they think it's fine because they know if the law went away, you know, the guy down the your competitor down the street starts opening on Sundays, you'll probably be compelled to do the same. But at the same time, the legislature is not getting any, you know, and again, it's a pretty low stakes thing, but they're getting like no pressure from car dealers or probably the public to change this. And there is, at least in our state and others, sort of this convention that if you are actually looking for a car that you can kind of wander around on a Sunday through car lots and know that you won't be bothered by a salesperson. And then if you actually find a vehicle you're interested in, you can show up on Monday and, you know, try to broker a deal. But like that, to me, this whole like concept is like, to me, lowers trust in small ways with our government and with car dealers, because it's like nonsense that like you can't go out and buy, it's not legal to buy a car on Sunday at your local dealership. I mean, there's no logical reason for that at all. But it's just this convention that we have in place kind of between the car dealers, which, by the way, in most states are a pretty significant political force, and the legislature. And again, I don't know if this quite fits in our discussion or not, but like, what's your, am I wrong to be bothered by this rule?
Well, yeah, but I think you're it's bothering you as an example, right, of many other kinds of rules where we can't see the reason for them.
Yeah.
Like, and there's some legacy. There's a long historical explanation for why the rule is in place, but we don't see what it is. And so if we don't see what it is, we tend to be really bothered by it.
Yeah. And wouldn't it be interesting if like you're in a competitive car market and you decide to open a car dealership and, you know, you're going to start selling cars on Sundays. You know, are the police going to show up? Are they going to like, you know, cuff you and take you to the jail? I mean, it would just be like interesting to see like what the reaction would be to something like that.
There are a lot of rules in place in organizations and in society in general that we can't see the reason for them, and yet there is a very good reason.
And, well,
being frustrated just because we can't see the reason is not, it's not actually a rational response.
I did a tiny bit of talking with someone about this once, and the reason I was given actually is that the vast majority of car sales, people are taking out a loan, right? I mean, not everyone, but the majority of them. And the majority, I mean, the vast, vast majority of banks, not by law, but by choice, aren't open on Sunday. Yeah. So their position is that but at the same time, you could ease, but more people, my rebuttal to that would be more people are like me and you are off work on Sundays. We could go in, fill out every bit of paperwork, and then the dealer could submit it Monday morning.
They could do the test driving, all that sort of thing.
And then here's the loan application, and then we'll call you back Monday. So I don't quite buy that, but that was the reason I was told.
Yeah. Let me liken it to safety regulations. And this is, if you go into any manufacturing plant in this country, you will see all kinds of safety regulations that the reason for them is not immediately obvious to the outsider just walking in. And you're putting a hard hat, you're putting on steel-toed boots, or like there's some rubber slip-ons that have a steel toe, sometimes safety glasses. There's lines on the floors, and you have to stay within the lines, and you have to know you're going. There's other places where you can't cross. And it's not really obvious, and you're thinking like, you're walking down the line, so there's a yellow line here. So if you step 1 foot over, you're unsafe. And if you're 1 foot in, no, not exactly. But they're boundaries that are established. And they get established over time because there's all kinds of bad things that are foreseeable, yet not exactly predictable. Like, they don't know that a certain bad thing is going to happen to you if you're not wearing a hard hat. But it's foreseeable that certain things could, say, on a construction site. There was a famous case in New York City where somebody drives into a lot where they're building a skyscraper, and there's a regulation on these sites where you get into the fenced area, you have to wear a hard hat. And this was somebody that was just, I think he was dropping off some plans. He has a hard hat in his car, or in his pickup. He's probably in a pickup. He didn't put it on because he's just stepping out. He's running into one of these trailers that's on the site, drop off these plans, coming back. Just as he steps out of his truck, a worker dropped a tape measure from like 15 stories. It bounces off a beam and continues down, hits this guy on the head. Well, what are the chances of that?
Yeah.
One in a million. It's probably less chance than getting hit by lightning, but it is foreseeable. It's the sort of thing that tends to happen. And there are a lot of rules that we have in place in society that are like that. Like things have happened in the past, and so then rules get established. Now, what we have to do as a society is you have to keep reexamining them. Have conditions changed? Is this rule still reasonable given like what the conditions are now? The reason for every rule is not going to be evident to everybody. We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. Scott, what is your question for me?
Rick, you may remember that after a couple of parking-related dilemmas, you told me I wasn't allowed to bring any more parking questions to the show in 2025. Well, it is now 2026, so here
we go.
Wait
a minute. I don't think that was the rule.
What?
I don't think I specified 2025. Oh. I think the rule was no more parking dilemmas.
No, I believe I was in like January, and I think it was our resolution show, and I think I made a resolution of this is like January of 25. I was going to do any more parking dilemmas.
We need a formal code of ethics here for this program, and one of the codes I'm going to propose is no parking dilemmas.
Well, if only we recorded these things so we could go back and listen, but I'm sure I'm right. But nonetheless, since that is not in place, here is my question. You, Rick Kite, are walking into a grocery store in your hometown, and you see a friend you know fairly well getting out of his car. And you're about to wave to him and say hi, and then you realize he's parked in a spot reserved for this little placard up for active or retired military members. You know him pretty well, and you're nearly certain he's never served. Do you say something to him?
So this is an old friend?
I've known this person for at least 10 years. Yeah.
Okay. Yep. Oh, yeah. I salute him and say thank you for your service.
And he gives you a look like, what are you talking about?
What are you talking about? Yeah. I would give him a hard time. Absolutely. Now, if it's somebody I don't know, I wouldn't know it, but if this is someone
that you're like, and you know, there's like that 1 in 20 chance he's like, you don't know this about me, but then you'd learn that he did serve at one time.
Yeah. And I would kind of do it jokingly to push him a little bit, but then I'd want to know, like when did you serve?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess to me, the broader question here is, and this is in our town, but I'm almost sure this is in most towns across the country, that, you know, when I was a kid, there were, and I'm sure still are, regulations about if you have so many parking spaces, you have to have so many handicap spots. And we understand that. And I don't think for a minute you think there's anything wrong with handicap spots, right? We should have those.
We should.
We
should.
We agree on that. So, but then there was sort of like what I'll call like category creep on this, is that they would then have like these, you know, military members, you know, active or reserved and signing just for them. And then you would have, I've seen newer expectant mothers, and they have a side space reserved for them. And there's maybe some other categories that I don't know about. And I thought, as we were talking on a show about rules, how do you feel about those other categories? Because again, we agree that the handicap spots are appropriate and we understand those, but those other ones, what are your thoughts when you see those?
I don't think about them at all. Unless you're in a parking lot that is completely full, except a whole bunch of open spots in the front, mm-hmm. that are reserved for these different categories and they're not being used.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is then if you think, okay, well, so what if, say, 6 of these were just turned into regular spots? Then there would be 6 more spots way at the back of the parking lot by the time I got in. Not one of those for me.
Oh, so, of course not.
Right. So then I think, oh, it doesn't matter at all.
But you've never served in the military.
Mm-mm.
But there's also, and I'm certain I'm right on this, although you can and should get a significant fine if you park in a handicap spot that you aren't supposed to. These other things are sort of in the honor system, right? I mean, the example we started off with a couple minutes ago, your buddy who parked in the veteran spot, we'll say he wasn't a veteran. You can give him a hard time, but he's not going to get a citation.
A few years ago, and my stepfather was quite ill. He was also a veteran, by the way, and he got a handicap tag for the first time for this car. And I remember we were visiting them down in Phoenix, and I was going to take their car to run to the grocery store to get some things. And he mentioned, oh, you can park right up front. I've got the handicap tag. And I thought, like, no, I can't do it. Like, it would be legal to do it because the car was designated that way. But it still seemed to me to be wrong, right?
Because you're not, you know, you're not, he's not with you and you're not
handicapped. He's not with me and I'm not handicapped. So, like, so yeah, so absolutely, I'm not going to do it.
But would you, if the spots were full, would you consider parking in one of those, like, veterans ones or new mom ones? Would that, I mean, there's not going to be, there's no legal recourse if you park there.
See, that to me makes it even worse. That there's no legal recourse. Then it's only, like, only your say-so. At least if I'm, say, if I'm parking in a handicapped spot without the tag, I'm taking the risk of, and it could be a calculated risk, of getting a fine, perhaps, if somebody comes and checks it.
Mm-hmm.
The other ones, I'm not taking any risk at all.
No, it's not all, at all.
So it's all, then it's
and
all.
Nobody, and I guess unless somebody even sees you, I mean, you could have been a person who served in the Gulf War. I mean, nobody knows.
It's so then it all falls on my conscience. And so then it's, it seems to me even like a greater test of character. And so, yeah, of course you wouldn't want to do that.
So then my final, then the trifecta of parking questions, you're in charge of.
You're so, really pushing it here, by the way.
I know.
So what you're trying to do is squeeze three parking dilemmas into one.
Well, they're all related. They're all related. So somebody put you, because they first of all, they listen to the show and know how deeply held, how important and these beliefs are and deeply held you have about parking.
Yeah.
And they decide to use you as a consultant for their next big retail development. And they talk to you and say, Rick, this new place we're building is we are going to have 500 parking spots. And I don't know what the ratio is for handicap, but we're going to have those as well. Of course we are. But we're unsure, Rick, if we should create some of these, you know, veterans ones or new mom ones. And this is a store that we hope appeals to everybody. It's not like a narrow casted store that is going to appeal to just a certain demographic. We hope everybody shops here. So, Rick, you're an expert on ethics and you're an expert on parking. What would you advise a store to do? Do you think it is good for them to put these non-required parking restrictions in their lot? Or do you think it just people look at those and say, yeah, they're taking all the good spots away because they didn't have to put this veterans thing here, and now I got to park farther away.
I would just ask, if I'm the consultant,
yes.
I would just ask them, do you think this is good for business? Like, why are you doing it? Do you think it's good for business? Have you had the experience where you have pregnant women coming in where they're walking a long ways and you think, oh, it'd be really good if we had a spot a little bit closer. And you have plenty of parking anyway, so it's not going to really hurt your business by reserving a couple spots like that, even if they aren't used that often. I would say if that's the case, go ahead. I mean, this is your property. And like most of the decisions you're making about design are just to facilitate business.
Yeah, and I think certainly that is why these companies do this, because in some ways, if you put that sign in front of your store that says reserved for active or retired military personnel, that is sending the message you hope that's sending is, this is a business that cares about our veterans and our U.S. service members. And that's kind of and that's probably why you're doing it, right?
Yeah, I would think so, and there's nothing wrong with doing that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So just good.
I would argue that there's nothing wrong with doing that as long as that's not the only thing that, like, all the other policies that are less public or less, you know, obvious are somehow. I guess maybe veterans is a little tougher argument to make, but around new mothers, there's probably a good argument to make there that you could have all these like new mom parking signs in front of your store. But then your policy is that as soon as someone's 8 months pregnant, they're just out the door and never to be seen again. And like, that's your sort of HR policy. Well, that would be like bad.
Yeah. And the other thing that would be bad if you just start creating all kinds of categories. So you like somebody says, well, what about this person? What about that person? And you start creating a whole bunch of categories. And we tend to do that lots of times in organizations, is like we do something well-intentioned for one group of people that it will advantage. And we say, well, what about this other group? And what about this other group?
Like, you know, you could say first responders, or, you know, that might be another one. Well, they're doing important work, Rick.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of worthy categories of people. And at that point, you aren't really recognizing anybody anymore, if that's the point of it. Now, here's where I do have very strong principled objections to kind of special or reserved parking spots. And this is when you reserve special spots for people in the company who have the high-profile positions.
Oh,
the
like the CEO. Yeah, yeah.
I think it's a leadership mistake to have those, because what you want is if you're in a leadership position, oftentimes there are several doors that people have to go through to get access to you, and there's all kinds of channels. And what you want is to be more broadly accessible, and a great way to do that is coming and going from your buildings. And you get a better sense of, like, what are the parking conditions for everybody who works here if you're one of the people that's parking wherever there is an open spot. You also end up having these really interesting conversations as you're getting out of the car and you're walking into the building, or you're walking out with somebody else. Whereas if you're like walking 10 steps and getting into your car while other people are going somewhere else, you're robbing yourself of another opportunity for interacting and getting really important insight into what's going on in your organization.
So, Rick, even though this dilemma clearly brought up many important ethical points that I'm sure listeners just learned an immense amount about, I promise you now that I will have no more parking questions for the rest of the year.
Yeah. Like, this one was so important, so valuable, that you might as well not even listen to 2025, because we did not have parking dilemas.
This will be it, though.
Do you promise?
For 2026, this is the only one. I'll hold them all until next year. This is from now on, I'll try to do just one a year. But I burned it, and it's not even.
I can't wait till you have a really big parking encounter with somebody in August, and you come to me like, can we make an exception to the rule?
Well, the as we
why
learned,
did we create this rule in the first place? Like, I don't see any reason for it.
As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And when you're sitting in your car parked in the lot, make sure to check out all of Rick's columns about ethics, and they can be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.